called Geology of the Pacific Northwest and Natural Hazards. So if you think you're here for, what was it, Peace and Justice, that's, I believe, next door. And my name is Jill Whitman. And I talked the other day about plate tectonics, which is sort of a theory which evolved about 30 years ago that describes some of what's happening on the Earth. And what I'm going to do is back up a little bit, so if anyone heard that talk, it's a bit of a review to sort of talk about plate tectonics in this part of the country, and then move on and talk about what that then produces in terms of some of the geologic features and some of the hazards associated with those features. My talk about natural hazards is not really intended to make people frightened. I think my intent is to make people aware that this is not a region without some hazards associated with it. And to sort of hopefully enlighten people about means to sort of think about this and put themselves in that context. For those of you who may have come here from Kansas, then it will simply be a learning experience about this part of the country. So you can go home and not worry about bolting your house down for earthquakes. I have this picture showing 832 on May 18, 1980, just as a reminder of the natural hazards here in the Northwest. And, of course, this was the very beginning of the eruptive process at Mount St. Helens. And then this is what happened to a lot of the area around Mount St. Helens. And we'll come back later on today and talk about that. And then also later on this week, I'll talk in some more detail about what some of the specifics were of the eruption there at Mount St. Helens. To start with, though, as I said, I'm going to back up and talk about this theory of plate tectonics. The basic sort of overview of the whole theory is that we can take the surface of the Earth and divide it up into a series of pieces which only represent a very thin layer on the surface of the Earth, and then these pieces move relative to one another. And this is a map that simply shows the different plates on the surface of the Earth and gives them some names. You can see that the one that is here in blue that occupies most of the Pacific Ocean is called the Pacific Plate, for not an unreasonable reason. And here we have the North American plate. You can see that it does not only include North America, but it in fact includes the western half of the North Atlantic. And that's kind of an important part about plate tectonics, is that our plates do not correspond to either oceanic material or to continental material, but they can include both. And the big deal about plate tectonics is that each one of these plates moves as a fairly rigid mass, tends not to experience much in the way of deformation in the interior of the plate, but where all the action is at the boundaries between two different plates. So what that means is we would expect to see things happening here along this boundary between the Pacific and the Antarctic plate, or along this boundary here between the South American and the African, or along this boundary here between what is called the Nazca plate and the South American plate. And then within any of those plates, within North America, or even here at the boundary between what we think of as the continent of North America and then the ocean basin adjacent to it, we wouldn't expect to see much happening, that sort of happening geologically. The kinds of things that we find happening are mountains being built, and earthquakes occurring, volcanoes, things like that. And so what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about each of the different kinds of plate boundaries and then come back and spend some detail on the specific plate boundary that we have. Yeah?
Why is the Rocky Mountains in the middle?
I can't answer that question for you. The Rocky Mountains are an enormous enigma geologically. Let me come back and talk about some of the places we build mountains and then talk a little bit more about sort of why the Rockies don't fit into that scenario. Before we go on, just to point out to you that here in this region there's a very small plate called the Juan de Fuca plate, and you can see that it's sort of snuggled in here between the Pacific plate and the North American plate. And since we're located right here, the Juan de Fuca plate plays a fairly large role in what's going on geologically here. So what we have are three types of plate boundaries. We have places where two plates are moving apart, where two plates are diverging from one another, and we call those divergent plate boundaries. They are always found in ocean basins, because what happens is we create new crust, and the kind of crust we create is an oceanic crust, And so we can see that these features here, which are sort of outlined in orange, are where we find our ridges. And in a cross section, well, we can also see what these might look like if we, in an imaginary fashion, drained all of the water out of the world's ocean basins. This is, you realize, an artist's rendition, somebody who's very creative to take the information about the depths of the seafloor and generate this kind of a map. It does not exactly reproduce what's down there, right? But we can use it as a start. And so what we see are these ridges are actually sort of underwater mountain ranges. The shading here indicates that the crests are higher and then the ocean basins get deeper as we move away from them. You can see that, unfortunately, this slide sort of doesn't stay in focus on the two different halves of the Earth. It doesn't like to stay in focus in the Atlantic. But there's a ridge that runs down through the Atlantic, separating North America and Africa from Europe and from North America and South America from Europe and Africa. The ridge here is called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. We have a ridge then that comes into the Indian Ocean and branches in a couple of different directions, and a ridge that then comes up here into the Pacific, and then a very small section of ridge again up here, separating the Pacific plate that we had in the Juan de Fuca plate. So at all of these ridges, the two plates are moving apart from one another and we're creating new material. Sometimes a divergent plate boundary will break apart two sections of continental crust, and one of the places where this is happening is here in the Red Sea. And so as these two sections of continental crust separate, we then create an ocean basin in between them. And just a satellite view of the Red Sea, whoops, you can see it, oh, we'll come back to that in just a sec. You can see this satellite view of the Red Sea then, here is Africa, here is the Arabian Peninsula, and basically we have a ridge that runs down through here and separates these two segments of continent as they move apart. If you go back to this one, what we see here is a cross-sectional diagram of what is happening. Two plates moving apart, hot molten material coming up between them. As it cools, that material is added onto these two plates, and these plates then grow along the divergent plate boundaries. Now, another type of plate boundary that we have is one called a transform plate boundary, and that's simply where two plates slide past one another. It doesn't show up in this kind of a diagram, but perhaps the best known of our transform plate boundaries is one which occurs on a continent, in North America, and that's the San Andreas Fault. There are other places where transforms occur, but basically what we have is a plate boundary that runs through here. And this crust here, where this is predominantly the Los Angeles Basin, is then on one plate, and this crust over here, on the other side of the transform plate boundary, is on another plate. This is the North American plate, and this is the Pacific plate. And so what we have is this part of California is moving northwards, sliding past this part of California. Is anybody here on Monday when I talked about plate tectonics? You won't be offended by my joke again, right? People always talk about California is sliding off into the ocean. California's not sliding off into the ocean. California's just part of California is simply traveling northwards. Los Angeles then is traveling northwards relative to the rest of California. And in 40 million years or so, Los Angeles will have traveled up to become a suburb of San Francisco. And the Dodgers and the Giants will once again be crosstown rivals. So the San Andreas is kind of a unique plate boundary of a transform fault because it occurs on a continent. Most of our transform faults are in the ocean basins and we don't observe them in quite such detail. Yeah.
So could you possibly say that a good explanation of a fault is a separation?
A fault is simply a place where Earth, the crust, because that's rigid and brittle, is sliding past another block of crust. Now in the case of the transform fault, if we're looking at it in a map view, they're sliding this way. We have many kinds of faults where the motion is vertical. And in fact, the kinds of faults associated with where we live are places where we have a vertical kind of motion along the fault. Now, the third type of plate boundary is one where we have a convergent plate boundary. Instead of two plates moving apart, we have two plates moving together and they're converging with one another. The problem with that is that the material on the two plates cannot occupy the same place. And so most of the time what we have is one plate here is bending and going down beneath another plate. This is the process that we call subduction, one plate being subducted beneath another plate. Now, there's a number of different types of convergent plate boundaries. We have some where two pieces of continent are coming together. Continental crust is very light compared to what we find in the ocean basins, and continental crust doesn't get subducted very easily. Instead, as these two pieces of continent come together, they simply deform, they're crushed, there's lots of folding of the rock, and it makes very tall mountain ranges. And the best example of that is the Himalayas, where we have the tallest mountain ranges in the world, because this continental material is coming together. And so, in fact, what's happening is the subcontinent of India is really on a separate plate from the rest of Asia, and it's traveling northwards, creating these big mountains. Some of the other places that we have convergent plate boundaries are where oceanic crust comes together with oceanic crust. And in fact, this kind of diagram is to illustrate that. What we produce, though, in this case, because this material of one plate of oceanic crust is being subducted, as it goes back down into the interior of the Earth, it experiences heating and melting. And you can see that one thing that's produced is that this material melts. As it melts, it's lighter, and it then rises to the surface and creates volcanoes. These little wiggly lines are also to indicate that this is a region under pressure, and so there's a lot of deformation of the rock taking place in this region as well. Folding and some faulting in this region. Now, this oceanic kind of collision, a very good example of that is Japan. The kinds of volcanoes that we produce are those such as Mount Fuji that is shown here in this picture. The third type of convergent plate boundary is where we have oceanic crust coming together with continental crust. And if we go back to our plate map, we can see that that occurs in various locations. Here we have the Nazca Plate, which contains oceanic crust of the Pacific Ocean, coming into collision with the South American Plate, which is continental crust. And we produce a very typical convergent plate boundary there when we have oceanic continental coming together. Great big huge mountain range again with a lot of volcanism associated with it here in the Andes. And the rock type, which is very typical of this type of plate boundary, is called andesite, named for this sort of having been the classic location. Another place that we have continental crust and oceanic crust coming together is here in the region where we live, in the Pacific Northwest. And this overhead then shows us kind of a schematic of what's happening all along the west coast of North America. Here you can see the Pacific Plate and the North American Plate and the San Andreas Fault, where we have this transform. And then we come up into this region, the North American Plate, the small Juan de Fuca Plate, and then the Pacific Plate out here. And this Juan de Fuca Ridge then is where new material is being created as these two plates are spreading apart, as we see here in this diagram. And then the Juan de Fuca Plate is coming into collision with the North American Plate. The Juan de Fuca Plate is then being subducted beneath the North American Plate. And so what we expect to have here are the same kinds of features that we've seen associated with some of the other convergent plate boundaries. And in fact, two of the most classic features which are found are volcanoes and earthquakes. And those are the two that I'm going to focus on for the rest of today, to look at the volcanism and also to look at the earthquakes. Yes.
I don't think a tidal wave.
We'll talk. Raise that again if I don't talk about it when I come to earthquakes. Now, to go back to the Rocky Mountains. The Rocky Mountains are located right here. Are they in a plate boundary? No, they sit right in the middle of the North American plate. Well, there was a convergent plate boundary along this part of North America up to about 30 million years ago. And some of the early formation of the Rockies started at that time as a result of that collision of two types of crust. But what is happening today is something that really confounds people. And through time I've read various things about it, and I think the problem is nobody really knows exactly what's going on. It's a very different kind of mountain building process than we find associated with a convergent plate boundary. And there's some kind of uplift which is taking place and obviously producing very large peaks. But the Rockies, I mean, you can look at almost every other mountain range in the world, and it was either due to an ancient collision between two plates. The Urals, for an example, are a perfect indication of when Europe and Asia collided. And you then have this north-south mountain range between those two continental pieces. The Alps are formed by the present-day collision of India, which actually rides, of Italy, which rides on the plate, which is part of Africa, which is then plowing northward into the plate, which is Europe. And so you produce the Alps there because you have continental-continental collision. But then there's the Rockies. And I guess every theory, and I think that's something that's important when we think about plate tectonics, is that it's a theory. It's taught very much as sort of being the truth geologically nowadays. There's a lot of evidence to support it, but it's still a theory, and not everything fits that theory very well. And it may be that in another 100 years there will be another theory which works better. The region of the Pacific, which we're going to be looking at, is part of what is called the Ring of Fire. If we look all the way around the edge of the Pacific Ocean Basin, we find that there are volcanoes that almost ring the Pacific, running up through the Andes, and then sort of skipping North America until we come to this region of the Cascades, across the Aleutians, down the region associated with Japan, into the Philippines, and so on. And it's called the Ring of Fire because of the presence of all of these volcanoes. And we live here on this Ring of Fire. We were reminded of that 11 years ago with Mount St. Helens. There's no name which is really used to describe the fact that we also live in a region of a lot of earthquakes. And it's because, once again, it's associated with this convergent plate boundary. Loma Prieta was a very good reminder that there are earthquake hazards associated with all types of plate boundaries, including the transform fault one here in this region. Okay, I want to go on and talk about both volcanism and earthquakes, but before I leave sort of this brief summary of plate tectonics, are there any questions? No, that's okay. I got more slides. I'll let you know. Thanks. Yeah.
All of these mountains that we're in right now, are these a combination of uplifting and volcanic?
Yes. This part of the Cascades is very different from the part of the Cascades from Mount Rainier South. And what we are sitting on here, if you want to come back tomorrow, you can hear a little bit more about that. But what we have here is a lot of deformation of very, very old rocks, which have been brought in and added onto North America. And then on top of that, we've built some volcanic peaks like Glacier Peak and Mount Baker.
Well, brought in
by glaciers? No, brought in by this whole process of plate tectonics. If you had a very large plate sitting out here, and it's coming in towards North America and being subducted beneath North America, if it carries a small section of continental material on it, that material is too light to be pulled down in the subduction process. So it doesn't go down like this, it ends up sort of being what we call accreted or added on to the continent. Turns out that the density of oceanic crust and continental crust is very different, so that this process affects the two types of crust quite differently. And so, if we look at fossil indicators in particular from this region of the Cascades, it shows that these were blocks that were transported that were once continental blocks in tropical latitudes and then were carried on this plate and added on to North America. So it's a real interesting mixture of things here. But for Mount Rainier South, it's much more typical of this kind of convergent plate boundary.
Yeah,
yes. This is the Pacific plate and the Juan de Fuca plate and the North American plate.
Will that disappear then eventually?
Well, it depends whether the convergence rate is greater or lesser than the divergence rate here. Yes, because if you're still creating new material, if you create it fast enough here, you'll still maintain this ridge. But in fact, it is probably ridge is going to disappear.
What evidence do they have that crust is going underneath?
Earthquakes in particular. The earthquakes we can see, and I'm going to come back to this when I talk about earthquakes, but earthquakes have sort of outlined this section of plate as it goes down. Okay, I'll come back. Other questions about plate tectonics in general?
Yeah.
No, that's... Okay, what we're then going to be talking about, whoops, I turned this off, is this region here of the Pacific Northwest, and looking at these various mountains, which we, many of us sort of know one or many of them by name, that make this line up here through the Pacific Northwest. Well, how are they produced? They're produced by this process of the collision of material, the melting of the material going down in the subducting plate, and it rising up to the surface. It's a very interesting type of volcanism. We have volcanism in other parts of the world, which is a very calm kind of volcanism. If anybody has seen any of the footage of the eruptions on Hawaii, for example, sometimes there's great lava fountains which are shooting up vertically, but then the lava tends to flow. And it flows at a rate that people can go out and watch. There's all sorts of footage which shows geologists, who are always slightly insane when it comes to things like this, actually getting up there and taking samples from this hot flowing lava. But if you remember, whenever it was 2 or 3 years ago, when some small village was threatened by a lava flow, they had enough time to evacuate. They were, you know, they knew that this flow was advancing. And that type, huh?
So it was really slow.
It's slow, right? I mean, it flows slowly. It looks like it's moving fast, but it flows at a rate that we can actually go out there and watch it as it moves. And it gives us some warning about what's going on. Now, in contrast to that, what we have happening here in the Pacific Northwest is a very different kind of volcanism. Part of what is going down in that subducted slab of material is a lot of water that's trapped in the rocks and in the sediments from the seafloor. And when that water ends up in this molten material that rises back to the surface, it makes for very explosive volcanism. And I think all of us were reminded, at least either at the time or subsequently in seeing pictures, that the eruptions of Mount St. Helens were extremely explosive. If we look at a picture here of Mount St. Helens prior to the eruption, one thing that happens is that sometimes there are flows associated with this, but it's material that's very thick, very gooey, and it doesn't flow easily, so it piles up and makes very steep-sided cones. And in Mount St. Helens, this is the pre-eruption of 1980, was always referred to as the Fujiyama of North America because it had this beautiful conical shape in the same way that Mount Fuji does. And when it erupted then, it erupted in a very dramatic fashion. Its eruption had actually been predicted by scientists who'd gone out and studied the geology of this region. And they had said in 1978, a pair of geologists who worked at the Geological Survey had said that Mount St. Helens has been more active and more explosive during the last 4,500 years than any other volcano in the lower 48 states. And they then said that they thought it was the volcano most likely to erupt. And as we know, the eruption actually had a bit of warning before it. There were some very small earthquakes which were monitored, and there were some small eruptions of ash that then coated the mountain. And this picture was taken before 1980. Pictures that were taken early in 1980, between March and May of 1980, show sort of this brown coating up here as ash was spewed out. On May 18th, however, the eruption was very dramatic, and this is a shot taken from an area called Bear Meadow, looking at the volcano as the eruption took place. I'm sure many of you have seen some of these pictures before, and the eruption as it sort of grew in size. And then one of the things which went on for a number of hours was this huge column of ash which is being spewed out. And this doesn't resemble the type of eruption which we find in Hawaii at all. This is ash. It's a very explosive kind of eruption. The ash column was somewhere in the order of about 15 miles in height. And as we know, the devastation which resulted from this was huge. Here we see a view after the eruption, looking right into the crater. This entire area was devastated out here, and the mountain now goes across something like this. On the north side, the crater is very deep here. We can see that this was the original shape of the mountain. So this explosion blew off the top of this mountain. And it devastated the area around it, flattening all of the trees. We have somebody here who then went in and pulled out lots of these trees. And I heard a story, and maybe you can verify, that the Tacoma Dome, does anybody here know the Tacoma Dome in Tacoma? You see it when you drive on I-5. It's the largest wooden structure in the United States. It's made primarily from wood, from the blowdown from Mount St. Helens. Is that true?
I doubt that very much.
Somebody actually checked, it was built just after the eruption, and somebody called the city engineer who said that that was in fact true.
Well, there might be some lumber in there. The main beams are glue lamps, and they're manufactured in Springfield, Oregon.
But the exterior surface?
That's possible. I don't know that.
Hi. Somebody say something? Oh, not to me, huh? I'm sure many of you have sort of heard some of the statistics with this eruption. This was actually a very small eruption for the Pacific Northwest. The statistics are that 57 people were killed. About a third of a cubic mile of material was blown out of this mountain at the time of the eruption. It devastated about 200 square miles if you look down at an aerial view. And this ash plume, as I said, that was produced was about 15 miles high. The explosive capabilities of this were somewhere in the order of 27,000 Hiroshima bombs. So, I mean, it's big in terms of what we think of in terms of human-created events, but it's still small relative to what else has happened. Some of you may know of some of the other volcanoes which we see in the Pacific Northwest. This is Glacier Peak, and 12,000 years ago, Glacier Peak had an enormous eruption, where the ash and pumice from Glacier Peak was blown further than the ash was blown from Mount St. Helens. In this area, sometimes you'll still see pieces of pumice. There's a layer of pumice that you can find as you dig down, and that comes from this eruption of Glacier Peak 12,000 years ago. But Crater Lake erupted about 6,600 years ago. It was called, as people, geologists who study it, and from Indian legend, it was called Mount Mazama. Now, I said that the volume of material blown out of Mount St. Helens was a third of a cubic mile. The volume of material that was blown out of Mount Mazama was 10 cubic miles. And so we are familiar with the hazards that were associated with Mount St. Helens, and yet in the not too distant past, there was an eruption of much greater magnitude. And so that threat is still here for this area. And hopefully, as in the case of Mount St. Helens, we have some kind of warning about some event like that impending. But we need to realize that small kicks to our consciousness like Mount St. Helens, there are bigger things which can happen out there as well. One of the other threats, which is one that people do not think of very much associated with volcanoes in the Northwest, is mud flows. This is a picture of Mount Rainier. Mount Rainier happens to have a system of 26 glaciers on it. What happens if you take and you just even start to heat the summit of Mount Rainier? What's the first thing that's going to happen before you even have any kind of an explosion or a lava flow of any type is that you're going to melt all of those glaciers. And then if you add some ash and debris which may come out of an eruption, you produce a wonderful thick slurry of material which can then flow down. And, oh, actually, I'm sorry, this is not a picture of Mount Rainier. Does anybody know what it is, picture of? I'm going to move. No, it's actually Lassen. And Lassen is a great way to, I'm going to talk about Mount Rainier. Mount Lassen erupted between 1914 and 1916. This is a picture on the north slope of Mount Lassen. It's sort of as high as you can drive off season. And this is an area that was completely covered by a mud flow in 1915. The eruption came out of the summit and kind of flowed down around this way. This area was completely devastated. You can see that in that interval of time, now material has grown back up. Well, Mount Rainier has had its history of eruptions as well. This is then a picture of Mount Rainier. I apologize. You can see the glaciers which are here on the surface. Glacier coming down here. If you look at Mount Rainier in an aerial view, you see that it's just ringed by glaciers all flowing off in different directions. Well, again, Mount Rainier has its history. This is a picture of the Emmons Glacier, which is on the east side of Mount Rainier. You can see it from Sunrise if you drive up to that area. But if you look at Mount Rainier here, so slightly after the eruption of Mount Mazama, there was a very dramatic mud flow which came down off Mount Rainier in this direction and flowed along here. It was called the Osceola Mud Flow. It covered this area with up to as much as about 100 feet of mud and material which had come off of the volcano. What they've done here is then show the risk to different areas. An interesting thing is that you can see the boundary between some of these risk areas has actually been produced by human structures such as dams in their hope that they would in fact trap some of this material as it came off. But a large enough eruption is not going to be, or a large enough mud flow is not going to be held back by any of these dams. Now, I'm a geologist and I really ought to know better. I happen to live where this dot is. So, and I live in an area where there is some risk. It's very fertile because this great floodplain from a river and various debris carried off of the volcano. But the Mount Lassen mud flow was one that kind of shook people up and realized that there was a potential for this kind of an event. But if we go back into what is in part recorded in Indian lore as well as the geologic evidence to show for this, we can see that there have been much larger mud flows, much more devastating kinds of mud flows. And I'm going to be talking in some detail about Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens later on this week and coming back and looking at some pictures of these kinds of things. But what I want to do now is move on and talk about earthquakes. Does anybody have any other questions about volcanoes? Yeah.
Can you say anything about this plain that I understand is made of lava that's between Spokane and this area?
Oh, the, yes. Right. I have to, this horrible confession, I'm not from this part of the country. I've been teaching out here for a couple of years. This is my first time I've actually been on the east side of Snoqualmie. I have lots of pictures of eastern Washington that I've seen, and I've been down along the Columbia River Gorge, and there, once again, the Columbia Plateau basalts outcrop along the river gorge. That is a kind of volcanic rock which comes from a more quiet type of eruption like that of Hawaii. And Hawaii is a very unique kind of a setting. It's not at a plate boundary. It sits in the middle of the Pacific Plate. Why should we have volcanoes there? Well, we have features called hot spots, where there's an isolated volcanic center, which is produced by some localized melting down in the interior of the Earth, which comes up to the surface, not related to the interaction of any two plates. And there's a hot spot which has made its way across North America as that plate carrying North America has moved across the hotspot. And we can see the traces of it in the Columbia Plateau basalts, and then the present location of that hotspot is further to the east. Does anybody know where it would be?
Yellowstone.
In Yellowstone, that's right. It sort of has moved across through the Snake River Plain and now is located in Yellowstone. So that, once again, was the type of eruption of Hawaii, huge amounts of material flowing out very gently. Does that answer your question?
Well, did it sort of fill up a basin?
And it covered over a lot of material. And one of the things is that if you put material on the continent will subside a little bit. It's like floating a block of wood in water, and you put another block on it, and the block settles a little bit, and you add a little more weight. So the same kind of thing happens on a continent. If you start to pile up a lot of lava, you'll be able to pile some more as it subsides. But it is built thick. Yes.
How old are those basalts?
17 million. Plus or minus. Yeah.
Are any of the other Cascade volcanoes currently showing any activity?
Well, that's saved up in part for tomorrow. We can use this as somewhat of a promo. I'm going to talk about the different activity of them. Currently, geologically, is very different from currently in a human time scale. And are they going to erupt in our lifetimes? Who knows, but none of them are extinct. And you probably wouldn't even classify them as dormant, which is this idea that they're kind of sleeping. They're active, they're just not active today or even last year. Because what's happening is we're taking in and thrusting this oceanic crust beneath the continent constantly. And so it's got to be producing molten material, which is gradually making its way to the surface.
I don't understand just what a mud flow is and what
a mud flow is. A mud flow is a combination of water and particles of soil and rock. And what causes it here in the case of Mount Rainier is that you take and all of a sudden release a lot of water if you heat the summit of that volcano and you melt the glaciers. And so as that water flows down, it may simply pick up debris and carry it along. Or in the case of the Osceola mud flow, basically the top of Mount Rainier was blown off at that time as well, just as in the case of the Mount St. Helens eruption. So you had all this ash, which was then incorporated into this water as it flowed down.
That's different than lava.
That's right, but it flows very much like lava. I don't know how many people have hiked up here to the third level of the mine tailings, but as you come up toward the highest level, there's this place where there's a very small mud flow, which took place, I guess, last winter, was what the museum curator told me. In the same kind of way, there was a lot of runoff from the winter storms, and that was enough to sort of loosen some of the debris and it flowed down. So mud flows happen in all different kinds of magnitudes. I mean, some ways we have mud flows, all of us, in our yards each year. Yeah.
What does the Osceola mud flow look like now? What kind of land is that?
Flat, river valleys, fertile. It makes its way down the, this is the Green River Valley here. Which then comes and becomes the Duwamish once you cross the Seattle.
Is that the Red Mountain Dam that you have?
You know, I don't know that, but
the White River?
It may be.
So that'd be about Enumclaw, Blackburn.
Got me. This is where my. You can tell that I didn't grow up around here. People say Enumclaw, and I know, well, yeah, it's east. I have to say I haven't been there, yes. That's probably right, but I'm not 100% sure of that. Now, there was an earlier, smaller mudflow which came down in this region, and called the Electron mudflow, and once again, it just kind of flows up, fills up a valley, and, you know, it's a lot of rich soil. That's why people live there. That's why we live in Puyallup. Yeah.
My question is, the way we're changing the environment, is that going to affect us at all?
Sure.
And how? Because it seems like
you screw with the natural flow path of a river or a valley or whatever, and it's going to go someplace else.
But how is that going to affect the plates?
It's not. Oh, is it going to affect the plates? Well, the only kind of effect that human activity seems to have at any plate boundary has been along the San Andreas Fault, which is a much shallower kind of feature than some of what we're looking at here. And they've pumped water in and out of reservoirs and things. And
well, how would it affect Mount Rainier, changing the rivers and the mountains?
It wouldn't affect the mountain itself, but it would affect where the mud flows go.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised, in a sense, at the dam being considered a safety net, because if you had a catastrophic mud flow, the dam would act to multiply the effect downstream. Instead of allowing the mud flow to pass on through, it would build behind the dam and then take the dam
out. Sure, it depends
out.
Where you live, right? I mean, you know. As to whether you view it an asset or not, I mean, I hate to say it, but I'm afraid if we had that kind of an eruption, that would be the least of our concerns for much of the area. Okay, so we move on to earthquakes. As I said, we have things happening where there are plate boundaries. And here, this goes back to the map showing the different plates. And these little red dots all indicate where earthquakes have occurred. Actually, the green, red, and blue dots all do. And it simply has something to do with the depth where the earthquake occurred. But you can see that we have divergent plate boundaries and we have earthquakes associated with them. They usually aren't a problem for us because the divergent plate boundaries are far enough away that they aren't creating any hazard for us. You can see that there are also earthquakes associated with convergent plate boundaries. A wonderful band of them here in the Andes and in Central America. The Aleutians, as we come down in the Western Pacific, splits because there's a small plate here. You have the Mariana Islands out here, the Philippines in here. And then various trenches, which are very complicated here, and then the Tonga Trench as we come down through here. This is then our ring of fire where we find volcanoes. It's obviously also a ring of earthquakes around the Pacific. And the density of Dothan here isn't such to show much in the way of earthquakes in this region. We're going to look at a closer view in this area to see that, in fact, earthquakes have occurred here. You can see that there are earthquakes associated with the Rocky Mountains, and obviously something's happening. What is an earthquake? An earthquake is when you build up enough strain in the rock that it gives very suddenly. And you take something and you try and slide it along on a surface, and you push, and it doesn't move, and then all of a sudden it goes very fast. That's the same kind of a thing that it is an earthquake. And that happens when crustal material is moving past another block. And so obviously that kind of thing is going on here. This is a very interesting region here. Does anybody know what the name of this area is, where these earthquakes occurred? No, this is the New Madrid earthquakes. Remember? There was supposed to be a huge earthquake in the New Madrid region in Missouri, right along the Mississippi last December. It had been predicted and predicted, and people were moving out and going to other parts of the country. And did it happen? No. It was predicted by a variety of different techniques. There were some very large earthquakes there. In fact, one of the largest earthquakes in the United States took place there in 1811, and another one in 1812. Why do we have earthquakes there? We don't really know. It doesn't fit in our story very well, just like the Rocky Mountains don't fit in our story very well. But if we move on to look at what happens at a convergent plate boundary, I'm going to show you a diagram which is not from the Pacific Northwest, and then we'll look at a bunch of figures which are from this area. This is just an example here of the Tonga Trench, but you can see that here, once again, there's subduction of oceanic crust beneath another plate. And where do the earthquakes take place? Where they take place, where these two blocks are sliding past one another. And you can see that the earthquakes start out, they're shallow earthquakes here at the surface, and then they become deeper and deeper as the subducting plate goes down into the interior of the earth. And so what this shading on the surface is intended to indicate is that right along the edge of the plate boundary, where there's very often a trench, you would have shallow earthquakes, and then they would be moving deeper and deeper away. Where we live in terms of the Pacific Northwest is very close to a trench here, and it's kind of an unusual setting here so that we don't get many of the very deep earthquakes. The plate doesn't seem to be going down quite as steeply. But we can have a couple of different kinds of methods of creating earthquakes. And one is this sliding of blocks. And if you remember, the eruption of Mount St. Helens had an earthquake associated with it. And very often the movement of this molten material up through the earth can produce earthquakes. And we'll talk about one example of that as well. A couple of terms which get used is that we say that the focus of an earthquake is here where the actual movement of the material took place. This is the focus of the release of energy. But most of the time we're concerned with where the energy was concentrated at the surface, because that's where we all live, is on the surface of the overlying crust. So we use the term epicenter. I'm sure that's a term that you all have heard. So the epicenter of an earthquake is the point on the surface immediately overlying the focus of an earthquake, so that the crustal movement doesn't have to have taken place at the epicenter. It may have taken place at some depth beneath that epicenter. And so you can think of that when you hear that term in the future. At this point, I'm going to finish with slides and move on to some overhead. So if you can turn that off, that would be great. Thanks. There are two different ways for looking at the measurement of earthquakes. Two different scales. One is called the Richter scale, and the other is called the Mercalli, or the modified Mercalli scale. Most of the time, we all hear of earthquakes being measured using the Richter scale. Richter scale was developed early on in this century. I don't know, it was about 1910, 1911 or so. And the way it is measured is by having an instrument out there which actually measures the amount of energy that was imparted to the surface of the earth from that movement of the crust. And so it's measuring what we call the magnitude of the earthquake, which I showed you here is basically equal to the amount of energy associated with that earthquake. The range that's used for a Richter scale ranges from 0, obviously means there was no earthquake, up to something slightly greater than 9. There are earthquakes of magnitude 1, 2, and 3, which are very small and we don't feel them. One of the really important things to remember when you hear about the Richter scale is that an earthquake of magnitude 4 is 10 times as big as an earthquake of magnitude 3. It's because it's done on a logarithmic scale. And so by the time we come up to big numbers, like earthquakes at the high end of the range of 8 and 9, we're not just looking at something that's twice as big as a 4, we're looking at something that's 10,000 times as big in terms of the amount of energy which is being released. And that's very important to think of. I just listed a few earthquakes which have occurred in the last few decades with some magnitudes associated with them, just sort of to remind you about what you may have known about that earthquake or heard about that earthquake and thought about. Christmas time, 1989, there was a small earthquake associated with Mount Rainier. It was big enough to wake people up. It was slightly after midnight and shook a lot of doors and windows and things like that. That was a magnitude 4.2. That was probably associated with some kind of motion of material very down deep underneath that volcano. The next two earthquakes are ones which were associated with the San Andreas Fault, magnitude 6.6, magnitude 7.1, fairly similar in terms of their magnitude. And you think of the devastation which resulted from those two earthquakes. Many people killed in both of those. Now, we move on. The Alaska, the Good Friday earthquake of 1964, was an 8.4. Well, why weren't more people killed from that earthquake?
Because most people.
That's right, because there weren't nearly as many people living in that area. The Chilean earthquake of 1960, look at how big that was. That's the largest measured earthquake since the Richter scale and since the instruments were developed. People heard about it, but it was off in another part of the world, right? I mean, it wasn't very close to home. What kind of plate boundaries are the Alaskan earthquake and the Chilean earthquake associated with? Convergent plate boundaries. What's happening in both of those? Oceanic crust is going down beneath continental crust. These two here were along a transform fault, the San Andreas Fault, but these are convergent plate boundaries. Okay, the other scale is one called the Mercalli or the modified Mercalli scale, and this one measures intensity, and it's a much more subjective type of measurement. It's measured on a scale of 1 to 12. It's always given Roman numerals to be able to distinguish it. And I'm just going to read you some of the descriptions which are used to assign intensities to different regions. Intensity is interesting because it depends upon a number of different things, what the material is on the ground underlying a region. And in the case of the Loma Prieta earthquake, you can remember that some areas of San Francisco were just absolutely flattened, and other areas were fine. The areas that were flattened were on loose soil, which shook a lot. So the intensity was greater there than the areas which were still standing, which were built on hard rock. Intensity 3 is felt indoors, hanging objects can swing, vibration-like passing of light trucks. Duration is sort of estimated, may not be recognized as an earthquake. You may not even have known that anything of an intensity 3 took place. By the time you come up to intensity 8, the steering of cars may be affected, damage to masonry, falling of chimneys, frame houses can be moved off their foundations if they're not bolted on, branches broken from trees, cracks in the ground on steep slopes. Wouldn't want to feel an intensity 8, right? Intensity 12, damage is nearly total, large rock masses displaced, lines of sight and level distorted, objects thrown into the air. Over the epicenters of the Alaskan earthquake and the Chilean earthquake, they experienced intensity 12. Things were just completely thrown out of whack from the previous situation. Okay, to look now at the Northwest, we can see that this is a region where, if we focus in on this just specifically, where there are earthquakes. And these circles are to give us an indication of the magnitude of earthquakes which have been measured in this region since 1960. Here you can see the ridge, and actually there are small transform faults which are offsetting the Juan de Fuca and Pacific plates here. And then you can see that there are earthquakes, fairly small earthquakes, which have been measured in this band up along the continent. focus of these is beneath the continent and the epicenter's on the surface. Are we looking at very big earthquakes on the continent? No, not very big earthquakes. We see that there were some that got up, particularly here around the Puget Sound region, got up into the sixes. And we'll come back and we'll look at those. But a lot of smaller earthquakes, telling us that there, yes, there is earthquake activity in this region. If we look at this now in terms of what the intensity was at the epicenter of these earthquakes, so now we're moving not from away from the Richter scale back to the Mercalli, we can see that there were Mercalli intensities of greater than 8 felt in these regions. Now remember, the 8 was falling chimneys and houses moving off their foundations. When did these earthquakes take place? Well, there have been a series of fairly large earthquakes. You can see them dotted down here. There was one, Mount Baker, this is actually estimated since there were no instruments there in 1872. But as we come through time, 1918 here on Vancouver Island, 1946 on Vancouver Island up there as well. 1949, there was one here, the epicenter was at Olympia. That was a magnitude, actually measured magnitude of 7.1. And then 1965, there was one here centered somewhere sort of under Federal Way or close to SeaTac Airport, which had a measured magnitude of 6.5. The 49 earthquake, there were 8 people killed, mostly from falling masonry. It was felt all the way from Oregon into Montana. And the 1965 earthquake, again, was one which had was felt all the way, this is now showing us the intensity, which was felt all the way eastward into Montana. You can see that in here, there were intensities, this is 7 within here, and then as that one map showed, it was an 8 centered immediately over the epicenter. And then moving out, so the people felt it much less as we moved eastward into intensities of somewhere between 1 and 4. The damage from that in 1965 was estimated somewhere on the order of $13 million. And again, there were 6 people killed during that earthquake, primarily from either distress or from falling masonry, bricks falling off the fronts of buildings and things like that. At the same time, 2 of the beer tanks at the Rainier Brewery were smashed, so sort of moved off of their positions and things fell on them. 1965 was a long time ago. We don't tend to think of that as the present day. And yet, 1949, 1965, people who've studied this area say that there's earthquakes of this size, which should happen maybe every 20 years. Something wrong with that number, isn't there? 1949, 1965, we're now into the 1990s. But there's always error, and we don't really know what the error is. Maybe it's 20 years plus or minus 20 years, so we have to wait another 18 years or so for something like that to happen. Sometimes it's less than that duration, sometimes it's greater. But recent evidence has suggested that earthquakes of magnitude 6 and 7 are very common, but earthquakes of magnitude 9 are also common in this region. And a lot of studies actually out here along this region have suggested that we have had large motions of the land surface. And one of the things that's often produced by large earthquakes are tsunamis, or what are called, often sort of erroneously referred to as tidal waves. Large waves produced by the motion of land. The Good Friday earthquake produced a very large tsunami. And what this one scientist has done, Brian Atwater, has found evidence for basically these tsunamis, or these waves generated by earthquakes out here in the sediments. He's found that there were nice marshes which were all of a sudden uplifted above the surface. And these kinds of things indicate that in fact probably there have been earthquakes in this area of magnitude 9. Now remember, it was an 8.4 in Anchorage and it was a 9.5 in Chile. The last one which shows up in the record was 300 years ago. Indian legend refers to some events like this. Geologic evidence and dating techniques have allowed us to actually measure when it took place. Brian Atwater's work suggests that maybe there's a frequency for an earthquake of a magnitude 9 of every 500 years. So 200 years from now is no big deal, right? But again, the big problem is what is the error bar. Is it plus or minus 200 years, in which case maybe it should have happened yesterday? And we really don't know that, and we can't actually come up with those kinds of numbers. People would like us to say very distinctly, there should be an earthquake tomorrow. I think the important thing to realize is that both from volcanoes and earthquakes, we live in what, as a geologist, I consider to be a very exciting part of the country in terms of what's happening, but it's an area where there is a threat to human activity, and we simply need to be aware of that. Students have to worry about, in our classes we talk about, what do you do to prevent an earthquake damaging your home? You tie your hot water heater up, right? Bolt it to the wall. Simple things like that. Just to make people aware, it's dinner. I don't mean to hold you on. My watch is obviously slightly off. But if people have questions about earthquakes in this area, I'll also be more than welcome to answer those. And I don't mean to leave you all feeling depressed. I just mean to leave you all feeling educated about this area. Yeah.
The Richter scale all over
the world? The Richter scale is a worldwide scale
used. Oh,
the devices to measure them?
Yeah.
Well, it sort of depends how much money people have raised in order to have them. There are areas where there's a very close network of the seismographs to measure them, and there are areas where they're great distances. Oh, they're in the state of Washington. There's probably hundreds, but you don't see. Well, I happen to have acquired one which is only about this big. It's not a very high resolution one. The ones which are used for very specific kinds of measurements are devices which are slightly larger, sort of sit in boxes. Basically, it's just something which has to be able to vibrate when the earth vibrates.
How far away can you measure earthquake with one of those?
Basically, all the way around the world. I mean, I was trying to think of one. There was, both when I was an undergrad and when I was in graduate school, we had good resolution ones, and we could pick them up from the other side of the earth, I mean from Tonga and things
like
that.
How does it do that?
Because the whole earth moves when there's an earthquake.
And could you tell from your...
Could we tell where it was? No, you have to have three earthquakes to be able to tell where it is, because all you can tell is how far away you were from the earthquake.
And could you still have to tell how strong it was in that area?
Like you once you knew how far away it was, you could tell how strong it was, yeah.
You said it had something to do with how the plate slipped down there?
Yeah, it's because there's basically, it's like friction. I mean, one plate's moving and builds up and all of a sudden it moves.
But you said that was the evidence that they used to figure it out?
The evidence for...
plate tectonics.
That, some of the evidence is simply this distribution of earthquakes occurs only in certain locations. And so something must be going on there that isn't happening elsewhere.
Is the other evidence that measuring the ocean floor and the ridges?
That tells us something about the kinds of features. Now we can actually get out there and measure. In the case of the San Andreas Fault is a perfect example. They can use lasers to measure the ground deformation between the two sides of the fault, the two plates, and see that there's actual constantly motion going on along there.
Are there places where they can see something around it like that?
It can be resolved by some geophysical kinds of techniques where you can actually use sound waves of various sort of frequencies to see this surface as it goes down, to image it. We'd love to see the interior of the Earth, and we sort of have to use very remote techniques. We think of remote techniques for looking at outer space, but we have to do that in the interior of the Earth, too. We can't drill down that far. So.
Didn't a lot of this come out once satellite photography was available?
That's helped. Actually, you know, it was World War II that really brought plate tectonics out of closets, because it was the study of the seafloor that really revealed a lot about what was going on.
Where did this copper come from?
This copper? Actually, this copper, one suggestion is that it was a result of volcanic activity. Basically, copper is present in very, very small concentrations in the rocks, but it moves very easily if you heat the rocks up and have fluid water and gases flowing through them. And so if you have volcanic activity, that even magma moving around at depth, the heat from that will make water migrate up through rocks, and then copper and other metals will get carried with it and then concentrated. And that's basically the understanding of most of the metal deposits.